nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
So it's our great pleasure to have Mark Ratner with us this morning. Mark is the Morrison Professor of Chemistry at Northwestern. He's won a lot of awards. I'll just mention three that seem significant to me. One is the Langmuir Award from the American Chemical Society in 2004. He's a member of the National Academy of Science, and he won the Feynman Award in Nanotechnology. He's active in six or seven major areas of research in chemistry. Those of us in engineering or electrical engineering, especially, just know him as the father of molecular electronics. And he's going to be here talking to us today about a gentle introduction to nanotechnology. Thank you for being with us.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, so you come to Purdue to talk about anything involving that little prefix, only with a tremendous amount of trepidation, because this is done better here than almost anywhere else I can think of, including by several of the people in this room. One of the advantages of coming from away is you get a certain amount of respect. And the other thing is that because most of the people who do nanoscience in this place are wonderful people, it's a little less intimidating than it would otherwise be. So that word actually is a Greek prefix, and it means dwarf. So we're going to talk about the properties of very, very, very small things. In science, the word nano is a prefix. It means 10th to the minus 9th, or a billionth. So a billionth of anything is a nano anything. So a billionth of a talk is a nano talk. And a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. So what we're going to try to do is nano 201. Nano 101 comes from reading the newspapers, because any of us who pick up the papers will find that nanotechnology is supposed to do all sorts of things for us, including some that I don't think it will do, and a lot that it will. So nano 201 is a sort of overview of what it all means in the context of 2006. And the best way to think about anything that's as small as a billionth is to think about it in respect to something else that we think we understand. So what I want to do is to start with a series of pictures that I pulled off the web that show, first, reduction in size, starting from an area which is 1,000 kilometers, about 600 miles across, and then we're going to go down till we get to the size that we can see with our eyes, and then instead of making things smaller, we'll make them bigger, and eventually we'll get down to the nanoscale, and in order to do that, we're going to have to drop down by 15 orders of magnitude, 10 to the 15th. So we'll start with the southeastern United States, state of Florida. The little red thing in the middle is going to be expanded on the next picture by a factor of 10. So the little red one that fills up the center of this is now the entire picture here, and we've gone from 1,000 kilometers to 100 kilometers across, 60 miles across. We're in northwest Florida inside that little red box. And we'll go down again to 10 kilometers. We're in the state capital, Tallahassee. Go down again to 1 kilometer, and we're at the National Magnet Laboratory, which is where the most powerful magnetic fields that you can get at are. Go down another factor of 10. We're at 100 meters, which is about 100 yards, lakes and oaks. Down to 10 meters, we're in the top of an oak tree. Down to 1 meter, we're in an oak tree. These oaks look a little different from the oaks in Illinois where I live, but they are oaks nevertheless. Go down to 100 millimeters, which is 10 centimeters, which is about 4 inches, and we're on top of an oak leaf. Now, this is the first actual size picture. So we started with a very large view of southern Florida. Now we've brought it down so that it's actual size. All these have been reduced. Now we're going to start expanding and start making them bigger. Go down to 10 millimeters with the surface of the leaf with the central spine coming out and the branches coming off of that. This is enlarged 10 times. Down to 1 millimeter. 1 millimeter is 1/10 of a centimeter, which is about 1/25 of an inch. And you can see the surface of the leaf. You can begin to see the substructure in the green part. Then we're going to go down to 100 microns. Now, 100 microns is a particular length size. It's the scale at which most human eyes don't work much longer. I mean, this is the size of a human hair, which is something I don't know a lot about. But if you look on a surface and you put one of these down, almost all of us could see this. Right? You'd take a hair and you'd see it on the surface. If you go down by another factor of 10 to 10 microns, most of us cannot see this. Some individuals can, most of us cannot. We're not at the nanoscale yet. Got a long way to go still. Down to 1 micron, the nucleus of a cell. And the nanoscale is normally defined as lying between 100 nanometers, which is the structure of chromatin, and 1 nanometer. And this factor of 100 is sort of by the definition of the marketplace what we normally think of as the nanoscale. Chromatin is the way that DNA is stored in many organisms. You see these coiled up worm-like things that in fact fill, for instance, the center of a virus. If we go down from 100 nanometers, which is the largest end of the nanoscale, to 10 nanometers, right in the middle of the nanoscale, you see the double strands of DNA. Okay, so now you're beginning to see the individual molecular subunits at the scale of nanostructures. And so this is an important thing, the fact that from 1 nanometer of individual atoms and molecules up to 100 nanometers, the structure of chromatin, this is the scale of nature. And one of the reasons that nanostructures are so interesting and important to us is that this length scale from 1 to 100 nanometers is the length scale of nature. It's the length scale on which we are designed. There are many smaller things in physics, but this is the one that's sort of concomitant with nature. So let's look at some nano objects that actually exist on this length scale. That's a flu virus. He's been magnified 300,000 times. He has a beautiful spherical symmetry and so on, but he's a nanoparticle. He's a large nanoparticle. Bacteriophage, slightly smaller nanoparticle. Those are naturally occurring nanoparticles. Here's some artificial ones. These particular ones were made at Chad Merkin's lab at Northwestern, but the point is you see a large nanoparticle in the middle, which is gold. You see small nanoparticles around the outside. Those are also gold. They've been magnified 500,000 times so that you can see them. They're held together by molecules that you can't see, but these are artificial structures that have been made on this length scale. Why is this interesting? Well, we'll get to that later. So far, we're just talking about what does exist on this length scale. And this is the world's smallest abacus. It actually consists of carbon-60 molecules, which are called buckyballs, and they're shaped like a soccer ball, made out of carbon, and they can be moved from one position to another on the surface. And so you can use this just like an abacus. You can move this, the carbon-60s from one place to another and do adding and subtracting in that way. Now, one question you might ask is, how do you move these C60s? You clearly can't move them with your finger. You can't move them with the tip of a pencil. So how do you move them? You can actually get on the website and move them with your joystick. But physically, how would you move something this small? And that, in fact, is one of the interesting issues about nanoparticles, which we will get to in a minute. So my university decided that small was big a few years ago. And this is an alumni magazine, which it sends out to all of its alumni, saying what's going on campus. And this is the cover of it that says small is big, the amazing world of nanotechnology. And you see different size nanoparticles with different colors. We'll talk about that in a moment. So the university decided to really make a major investment in small science and technology, and they began a series of new buildings, of which this is the first. The person on the right is Chad Merkin, who's actually the director of the Nanotechnology Center at Northwestern. The person on the left is me. That's my office. It was very small, but it was very effective. We didn't want to work in there for too long. Actually, the spot in back of it used to be the University Computer Center, and the University Computer Center was leveled, and they started building the nano building, and that's what it looked like at the beginning, and this is what it looked like when it was completed, and it's a nice building. And what goes on in there is building nanostructures, applying nanostructures, measuring nanostructures, and on the top floor, doing theory about nanostructures. Other places were also very forward-looking and did some really remarkable investments in nanoscience, both at the physical level and at the personal level. This is a sketch of the Burke Nano Center at Purdue. I'm happy to say that it's no longer at the sketch phase. It's at the actual things going on in the building phase. This is about twice as big as the one at Northwestern, and it's organized in a very different way. But many of the leading research universities and research corporations around the country have gotten into this nanoscale, nanoscience, nanotechnology area in a serious way and are making major investments. Why? So I've told you that it's small, but I haven't told you why small is important. So it's a special kind of small. As I said, you can get smaller. You can go to the nucleus of a particle. You can talk about subcomponents of the nucleus. You can talk about hadrons and leptons. But it's small for three reasons. First, it's the design scale of nature. I already showed you that DNA exists on this length scale. And then there's the process of self-assembly. and size dependence behaviors. And we'll talk about both of those, but let's go through these sort of in order. First, design scale of nature. Now, if you want to study and understand nanostructures, you have to be able to make them, so you have to fabricate them, and you have to understand their properties, either by modeling their properties or preferably by measuring their properties or best doing both. So as I said before, at 1 nanometer, we're talking about individual molecules and atoms, and then we worry about how you could understand these. Now, although nanoparticles were known at least as far back as Chinese pottery 2,000 years ago, and they were very well understood by people who built stained glass in medieval cathedrals, and even better understood by Michael Faraday in 1840, it wasn't until 1981, 82, 83 that modern science began to make real progress on these. And by real progress, I mean was able to measure, quantify, observe, and prepare these things. And this really did not begin at any university. It really began at IBM in Zurich. They made something called a TIP, or scanning probe microscope TIP. And what you see here is a modern version of what was done at IBM about 23 years ago. These little tips look like ultrafine nibs on pens. That's what they are, but they're very ultrafine. So at the actual tip, these are tungsten, these things have been magnified 1,000 times. When you get to the end, the curvature is on the nanoscale. The way these originally worked, so I'd like you to do an experiment. Close your eyes, take your right index finger, put it on your left elbow. And almost all of you are wearing shirts. Egal, you're not wearing a shirt. Do it anyway. Close your eyes and move it down the length of your sleeve until it gets to your wrist and it will fall off of your sleeve and land on your skin. And you'll feel the different drag on the skin. Keep going until you get to a fingernail and then you'll feel a different drag again. And what these things originally did was to understand the structure of matter by looking at the drag that was exhibited on this tip as it moved around the surface. That's what was done originally. What's done with them now is amazing. And one of the things you can do with these is to move those little C60 on the surface. So that's how that world's smallest abacus actually works. You do the manipulation using these tips. Now, although that experiment was actually developed in the early 80s, people had been thinking about nano behavior for a long, long time. And the prophet that's usually invoked at this point is Richard Feynman, best known to the larger community for his work on the shuttle disaster, the Challenger disaster, and what happened with it. But one of the great theoretical physicists of the 20th century, and he gave a talk to a bunch of alumni of Caltech. And this is called the Plenty of Room at the Bottom talk, and what it says is, well, this is the way it ends. As soon as I mention this, people tell me about miniaturization and how far it has progressed today. They tell me about electric motors that are the size of the nail on your small finger. And there is a device on the market, they tell me, by which you could write the Lord's Prayer on the head of a pin. But that's nothing. That's the most primitive halting step in the direction I intend to discuss. It is a staggeringly small world that is below. In the year 2000, when they look back on this age, they will wonder why it was not until the year 1960 that anybody began seriously to move in this direction. So this is Feynman's talk, 1960. Some things about the talk, about this picture of the talk to notice. First, it's a little hard to read, right? It's not really terribly clear. But that's because the letters that are used here are really small letters. These are nano letters. So that L is 60 nanometers across. The D on the bottom is 400 nanometers across. Remember, a nanometer is a billionth of a meter. These are really small. If you could write in letters this big, you could fill with 1 8.5 by 11 piece of paper, you could put 10,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So would you like 10,000 sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica on 1 8.5 by 11 piece of paper? No, wouldn't do you much good, right? Do people ever want to write information this small? Yes, they do, and we'll talk about that in just a second. The way this is actually made is using a program called WordPerfect, which some of you know. It's just a word processing program. And it's done using as the writing instrument one of those tips that I showed you, right? And just as WordPerfect can be used to do any font that you want, and you can make curlicues and lines and squiggles and self-portraits and all that, so you can do all of that at the nanoscale using this device. What's the device? Well, it's really simple. It goes back to something called a dip pen. Dip pens are what, when I was a kid in school, you sat at your desk, which is a wooden desk with a flap that came up, and up on the right-hand corner there was a little hole which had an inkwell in it, and there was a bottle in that, and there was black ink in that, and they gave you this pen, which you would dip in the black ink and write with. And then when the ink ran out, you do it again and do it again and do it again. Those were called dip pens. And what dip pen nanolithography is exactly the same thing, except instead of using this dip pen, you use an AFM tip. And I showed you that the AFM tip is nanosize. So the ink, or molecule, runs off of the AFM tip through a meniscus, which is shown at the bottom of the sketch, down onto the solid substrate. And as I move the pen, I leave the ink behind. So there are real externalities between the pen that's about 3,000 years old, probably, and the AFM tips, which are only 30 years old. The similarities are, in both cases, there's an external reservoir of ink, and the ink diffuses and is transported from the pen down onto the surface. The difference, basically, is that the lower one is 100,000 times smaller. And so you can write much smaller structures. As I said, this will give you line width such that you can put 10,000 sets of the Britannica on a piece of paper. Who would ever want to write this small? Well, we live in a complicated world. One of the things you might be worried about, I take Lipitor. Lipitor is made by Pfizer. But if you get on the web, you can find 100 sites, maybe more, that will sell you Lipitor over the web. Right? Pfizer is very interested in knowing that when you buy Lipitor over the web, it's really Lipitor. That it's not something made by somebody else, packaged under the name Lipitor and sent out. The reason for that is security. This is a kind of homeland security, actually. But if you imagine toxic agents entering the pharmaceutical industry, this could be a very scary and very unpleasant thing. So one of the things that the pharmaceutical companies are very interested in doing, including a major pharmaceutical company that's not very far from here, they are interested in writing on each pill where it was made, how it was made, and what date it was made. Well, how would you do this? Well, you want to write it in a code which is readable by the right people, not readable by the wrong people, stable, and doesn't interfere with the functioning of the pill. One way you could do that would be to write in vegetable dyes on the outside of the pill and to write in letters of this size. So there's actually a very large issue here involving authentication by labeling, and dip pen nanolithography is one of the ways people think about doing this. So, small. That's a different kind of small. Why it's important? Because it's the design scale of nature. Let's talk about self-assembly. So when you talk to people, you're looking at entities that are made of molecules, and those molecules have come together, right? Nobody made those molecules in a foundry and sort of pushed them together to form fingernails. The fingernails form themselves. They form themselves from a series of smaller entities that assemble to form us. And this process of assembly is coded into the molecules themselves, and it's called self-assembly. Now, this is an example from the work of one of my colleagues at Northwestern. His name is Sam Stoop. And Sam is interested in making molecules that will assemble to give larger mesostructures. So you start with a molecule, which is a small nanostructure, and it makes a large nanostructure, and that he wants to use for regenerative medicine. Regenerative medicine, the idea is not to do surgery and fix something, but allow the body basically to replace something that isn't there. So those of you with bad backs, you probably have bad backs because of cartilage problems. Cartilage is not regenerated. Sam wants basically to let the body make its own cartilage. So this is one of the examples from Sam's lab. The little cartoon on the right shows small molecules, those long skinny things with the colors on top, coming together to form a large pipe. And the large pipe has a radius of the order of 20 nanometers, so it's a nanoscale object. The molecules themselves are of the order of 1 nanometer in size. They're a nanoscale object. So nanoscale objects coming together to form larger nanoscale objects, which in turn come together to form even larger ones. So the micrograph on the left shows what happens when you take these pipes, lots of them, disperse them on a surface, and take a micrograph of them. And you see these long, skinny fibers. Now, the interesting part about this is the long, skinny fibers have a red, white, and blue outside. And red, white, and blue in this case is a code for a particular epitope. That means a small section of a peptide. And this particular small section of a peptide can be selected to bind to other proteins in the body. So basically what you're doing is making a roadmap for proteins. If you could form that gel, the thing on the left is called a gel, if you could form that gel in a particular region of the body, and if you coded, say, for growth factor on the outside of the cell, the growth factor would assemble and you would have growth factor growing in a part of the body where you want it to grow. And of course, if you coded for stem cells, this would tell the stem cells where they should go. And if you coded for particular cancer markers, that would tell the cancer marker where to go. The work that they've done so far involves some initial experiments using these in a regenerative medicine application. The application they're most interested in is spinal cord contusion injury. So you're skiing, you fall the wrong way, your back hits a log or a tree, and there's an injury. There's a traumatic event, and when you get into medicine, you wind up with the whole vocabulary, and you see words like necrosis and excitotoxicity and apoptosis, all of which are bad. And apoptosis is cell death, and what it means is that the cells around the injury are dying. So the cartoon that you see, imagine that this is a spinal cord. The little fibers up at the top are going to the brain. Down at the bottom, it's going to your feet. And there's been an injury. So the red thing is the scar that forms where the injury has occurred. The body self-protects by killing all those cells. Okay, so necrotic cell release. Right? So they all die. And you wind up forming a scar, which is called a glial scar. And this is a picture of what happens to a mouse that has spinal cord injury. Okay, so the brain is to the left, the feet are to the right, and you see this interrupted fiber tract. That's actually the fibers that transmit the signal. And it runs into the scar area, and you can see that there's a complete break in the communication system. It's like snipping a wire in a telephone. Right? What you would like to be able to do would be to enable those fiber tracts to bridge across the scar area, basically to regenerate the connection between the brain and the foot. And if you could do that, then the mouse would recover its foot function. So what does the nanostructure do for you here? How does it help? Well, here's the idea. You take the molecules, you put them together in the body, so you inject them into the body, they come together and they form this gel. The gel binds growth factor, the growth factor binds all sorts of things, and in particular, it binds those neurons and maybe stem cells. And then over a long period of time, the molecules themselves go away, and what you're left with is a natural structure. That's how it should work. So this is actually a three-dimensional scanning electron micrograph, and you can see this sort of three-dimensional texture of these interacting pipes that are all coated now to form growth factor. So this is the experiment. You take this mouse, which has a spinal cord injury. You inject from an hypodermic needle this so-called peptide amphiphile. That's the molecule that I showed you. It comes into the region where the scars are. It forms this gel, and then over a period of time, the body will bind onto that gel growth factor. So this is a collaboration between Sam's group and Jack Kessler, who's the head of neurology at Northwestern Medical School. So the injection time was 24 hours after the injury, and then 7 days after the injury. And what you see here, well, the idea is that if you're going to do medicine, you always have to do it on mouse models before you do it on people. That is not being done in the PRC, but it's probably the right way to do things. So this is what happened to a mouse. There's a control mouse and a mouse with the gel injected. I don't have the movies here where you actually see the little mouse running around the cage, but it's kind of interesting because you can see that before the injection, the mouse runs around, it drags its back feet, so it's propelling by its front feet. Afterwards, you see the back feet moving. It's really quite nice. Now, BBB score is basically a mobility score, how mobile the mouse is. And you can see that it comes back by a factor of 2 or so. This isn't perfect. But firstly, this was injected 24 hours after the injury. You really want to inject it much, much sooner than that because all this scar formation is going on. The most interesting part is that this nanostructure invades that scar. So the scar tissue is no longer a barrier to regenerating the spinal cord tissue. And that's actually interesting. And so this is very early days. This paper was published last year. But it's, I think, quite exciting as an application which involves something intrinsically nano, and that's this self-assembly issue, how molecules come together to form larger structures. So there is a book. Actually, there are lots of books. This is one that my son and I wrote. And on the cover of this book, and that's why I show it, there's a picture of a nanotube. Well, a nanotube is a pure carbon entity. This particular one is a very small one. You make them by subjecting carbon to very, very high temperatures. And they are very strong. They can be very electrically conductive in their typical nanostructure. So the width through this is about 1 nanometer. The length can be very, very long. These are totally nanostructured materials. They're just carbon, but carbon arranged in a particular nanoscale way. We've talked about fabrication. Let's talk a little more about properties. Now, I said that the nanoscale is not only small, it's a special kind of small. And what makes it a special kind of small is that properties can change with size at the nanoscale. Now, a macroscale analogy to this, we'll come to that in a moment, I'm sorry. Properties become size dependent. I already mentioned stained glass. Melting points of metal nanodots. Imagine you have a gold ring. You cut it in half. It's still the same color it was before. It still has the same melting point it had before. Do it again. It's still true. Do it again. It's still true. Do it again. It's still true. When you get down to the nanoscale, it changes. The color changes and the melting point changes. Because basically, as you get really small, more atoms are on the surface than in the bulk, and so it melts faster. It's easier to melt a nanoscale particle of gold than it is to melt a macroscopic property of gold. Well, here's an example. So these are nanoparticles made of gold and silver. And let's just look at the silver one. Starting on the far right, those small spheres at 40 nanometers, they look gray when you look at them. At 80 nanometers, they look sort of whitish. At 120 nanometers, they're slightly light green. And way over on the far left, 100 nanometer prisms, it's red. So I have red silver, yellow silver, green silver, and bluish silver. It's all silver. But at the nanoscale, its properties have changed with size. Excuse me. Macroscopic analogy to this is a bell. The best example of this is probably this. This is Saint-Chapelle in Paris, and you see these gorgeous windows that were made in the Middle Ages. Most of those colors, not all, but most come from nanostructures. So here's a 20th century application of the same idea. The colors of nanostructures made out of metal change with the size. The macroscopic analogy is a bell. A large bell makes a deep sound. A small bell makes a higher sound. A very small bell makes a very high sound. Because the bigger the bell, the more space the sound waves have to go in the bell. Same thing with nanoparticles. The smaller they get, the higher energy or higher frequency the optical excitations, because there's only a smaller space for the electrons to move around in. These are called plasmons, and they've been known for a long time. The first person to investigate them from a modern point of view was Michael Faraday, and if you go to London, you can walk into his old laboratory and see the ones that he prepared 160 years ago. They're just fine, different colors of gold. He didn't call them nanoparticles, because he didn't know that word. What you see here is an application of 19th century chemistry from Faraday plus 20th century chemistry involving DNA. And this is a detection behavior. This was developed by Bob Letzinger, Chad Merkin, and their colleagues back 12 years ago or so. So on the upper left, you see a cartoon, little gold nanoparticles, and the gold nanoparticles have fuzz on them, and the fuzz is single-stranded DNA. So you see there are two kinds. There are the kinds that have the red fuzz on them and the kinds that have the blue fuzz on them. Excuse me. And we're looking for a target. This is a detection analysis problem. So the target is the red-blue hybrid that you see in the middle of that picture on the left. The idea is that when the target is present, and only when the target is present, the blue part of the target will form a double helix with the blue DNA. The red part will form a double helix with the red DNA. And what will happen is it will bring the DNA particles closer together. And as the DNA particles get closer together, Faraday knew that's going to change the color. So here's the cartoon. I put them together, and the red binds to the red, and the blue binds to the blue. And you see that happening. And as that happens, the particles get closer together. So if you look on the right, the particles are indicated slightly closer together than they are on the left. And if you look on the lower left, you see an actual photograph of what goes on. With the target DNA, the thing is wine-colored. Without the target DNA, it's purple. And it's actually very easy to distinguish this. So it's a test for specific DNAs, because the only DNA that will cause this color change is one that binds to both the red strand and the blue strand. So if you have a target, for example, an anthrax target, then in the presence of anthrax DNA, and only in the presence of anthrax DNA, the colors will change. If you recall, just after 9/11, when there was all this concern about the powders that were found in post offices in New Jersey and whether they were toxic or not, this is a very attractive way to think about solving that problem. There are many other good ways, too. But this is particularly attractive because it's fast, it's cheap, and it's very general, in fact. So there's a machine, and you can go buy this. There's a company called NanoSphere that makes this machine, which they call the Varigene system. And basically, you take a medical sample, you slap it in there, it runs for a while, and then it prints out what you're looking for. So this particular one doesn't look for just one target like anthrax. It looks for 40 or 50 targets at once, and it tells you what your levels are of all of them. You can generalize this to a general diagnostic, and we'll talk about that toward the end of our discussion. I should say something about nano in the real world. Probably, from an economic point of view, the largest application of nanostructures is in petroleum processing. A zeolite, well, your great-grandmother probably had zeolites in her house because she used them for softening water. Zeolites are naturally occurring rock-type entities. They are silicates, and they have holes in them. This particular one is a Y zeolite, and you can see the small holes, the red thing, the green things are molecules, and the molecules fit into these holes in a particular way. So part of petroleum processing is called cracking. You start with very large molecules, turn them into small molecules, and by using zeolites with these nanoscale holes, you can make particular shapes of the final molecule. So you can build up the octane number of gasoline. My Catholic friends tell me this is probably a $100 billion a year industry worldwide. But since it's buried under names like ExxonMobil, you're not really aware of the fact that this is a pure nanotechnology, and a very important, significant one from an economic point of view. Now, if you work in the area of nanoscience or nanotechnology, people are always after you to talk about devices. Make us a device. Make us something that you can really use that's based on the nanoscale. In fact, at the moment, the current standard gate length for transistors is at the nanoscale. That was not true 10 years ago. It is true now. They've been getting smaller. But that's something that's buried inside a computer. If we think about a pure nanostructure that you can go out and buy on the marketplace that would actually do you some good, there are some. And the BBC website has this one to offer. It says, nanotechnology building from the bottom up. The cosmetics industry already puts nanoparticles in lotions, creams, and shampoos. Nano-sized zinc oxide particles are used in sun creams. The particles are particularly good at absorbing ultraviolet rays, but make the lotion transparent and smooth instead of sticky and white. It looks to me like that hand there has the old technology on it because it looks sticky and white. But this is available. It's actually made by a company called Nanophase, which is right outside Chicago. And these are simply oxides. Zinc oxide is the one that's used here. People who ski have used zinc oxide on their noses for a long, long time to prevent sunburn. The only difference is that now these have been made into a smaller size range, and so they have very attractive properties from the point of view of compatibility and lack of greasiness. So whenever you talk about nanoscience or nanotechnology, people are concerned about three or four important issues that I haven't talked about, and I won't say too much about. That's actually the subject of a different discussion. These involve things like education, equity, environmental effects, health and safety, and economics. Just a little bit about economics. The federal government spent in 2005 roughly $1 billion on the National Nanotechnology Initiative, on funding for nanoscience and nanotechnology. There's an estimate that in 2015, $1.2 trillion will be involved in the sales of nanoparticles or nanoentities. There are 41 of the 50 states that at the moment have active nanodevelopments, meaning there's some office in the state government that's trying to develop nanotechnology within that state. Anything that has those kinds of numbers associated with it, especially in the days of the internet, will have a great deal of hype associated with it. And this is a subject of its own, that can be quite amusing. Let me show you just a few examples. This one is from a magazine. If you look in the upper right in the small print, you can see the name of this magazine, which is Red Herring, and that's probably appropriate under these conditions. So this picture is supposed to show revolutionary forces that have acted in science and technology, going back to textiles at the end of the 18th century, to railroads, automobiles, computers, and then nanotech, starting, according to this, in about 97. We're still on the up curve towards 2025, and then peaking out maybe toward the end of the 21st century. It's not entirely clear that this means anything at all. But what is clear is that people care about this, and there's actually a lot of thought about how this is going to impinge on the marketplace and the workplace. There are other things. You can look on the web under nanotechnology and find all sorts of things. For example, there's this now website, originally magazine, called Nanotech Report, put out by Forbes, which is a fairly conservative organization. This was volume 1, number 1, and it says, a new world is born. Okay. Nanotech Report. So what they were thinking about is investment and how you could invest in nanoparticles and nanoscience. There are other things on the web, too. This one is called the Hedonistic Imperative, and this is a website. I give you the citation there. Just indicate the range of opinions that people have about nanoparticles. All the way from Michael Crichton's view in Prey, that these nanobots are going to invade our bodies and destroy our free will, to this one, which is substantially more optimistic. It says, the Hedonistic Imperative outlines how genetic engineering and nanotechnology will abolish suffering in all sentient life. The abolitionist project is ambitious, feasible, rational, and then it says it's ethically mandatory, which doesn't sound so good. The metabolic pathways of pain and malaise evolve because they serve the fitness of our genes in the ancestral environment, and they will be replaced by a different sort of neural architecture. States of sublime well-being are destined to become the genetically pre-programmed norm of mental health. And then it says the world's last unpleasant experience will be a precisely datable event. I live in Chicago, and I'm a Cubs fan. And so I know that that last sentence is not true. There's a nano device. This one is a tennis racket. Now, that doesn't look nano. Right? But if you read the small print here, this is from the Babala website, and it says VS nanotube power. And then it says carbon nanotube stabilizers increase the torque and flex resistance of this tennis racket. Now, I showed you a sketch of a nanotube before. It was this long, skinny thing that looks like chicken wire folded back on itself. Those cost of the order of about $1,000 an ounce. So there isn't a lot of nanotube in this tennis racket, but apparently there's just enough to make it a better tennis racket and justify its price. At the other end of the court, there is a nanostructure, and this one I do understand, and this one actually works very well. What these tennis balls have are layers of clay in them, and the layers of clay provide what's called barrier. In other words, there's gas inside a tennis ball, and the tennis ball goes flat and useless because the gas escapes. And what they've done is to install in this latex on the outside of the tennis ball, they've put small little platelets of clay, nanoscale platelets. And those actually do increase the barrier quality of this tennis ball, and pretty much all the balls you buy now are made this way. I did postdoctoral work in Denmark, and the Danes will tell you that Niels Bohr, who was a great Danish scientist, said everything that was ever said that was worth saying. Niels Bohr smoked a pipe, which he always had in his mouth, and he spoke Danish, and he mumbled, and he almost always turned his back to the audience when he spoke, and so people believe he said many things. This is one of the things he was supposed to have said. Predicting the future is very difficult. Americans think Yogi Berra said it. Whoever said it, it's true. Predicting what goes on to the future is really very difficult. But let's think about some targets for nanoscience and nanotechnology. I've talked a little bit about the science. Now let's talk about some of the applications, things that you could actually think of as major targets for this new kind of making things. I have two of them in black here because they're already available. You can go out and buy greaseless suntan lotion. We've already talked about that. And you can buy stainless ties for soup spillers. Basically, you can buy fabric that really sheds stains. There are things called nano pants, which are just ordinary khaki pants with nanoscale, in this case, fluorocarbon on the outside, and they really do work. I've tried them, I promise. They really do work. The things in purple are things we'd like to be able to do. Some obvious ones, advanced materials. Could you make a tire that doesn't have carbon black in it but has nanoscale particles of a different kind in it, which would give it much better flex capabilities and much better puncture capabilities? 5-minute health swab test. I talked about this device based on nanodots that you can now test about 40 or 50 biological targets at once. But what you'd really like is a complete analysis. You'd like your DNA sequenced. You'd like to be able to go into the doctor's office, have a sample taken from the back of your throat or someplace like that, sit there and read those magazines that have been there for the last 45 years, and then after 10 minutes have the doctor come out and the nurse tell you, well, you don't have measles, And you really need to get your tetanus shot up to date. And did you know that you've inherited G6PD deficiency and that you need to be medicated for that? That's what you'd like to have happen. This is one way that that might happen. Interactive glucose sensing and dosing. Diabetes is a huge and growing problem in all the world, first, second, and third worlds. We need to be able to solve this problem. And we know the science. All we need to be able to do is detect the glucose level in the blood, which will tell us something about what's going on, and inject or not inject insulin on a real-time basis. But you have to do it in a way that will really work. Human repair, I've already talked about some of the early work on the peptide amphiphiles, but there's a great deal more to do there, clearly. Optical computers, can we get rid of the electrons in our computers and replace them with light? There'd be advantages to that. Probably need a nanoscale solution to that. Non-freezing windshields, if you live where I live, and you wake up in January and your car's been parked outside and there's a quarter of an inch of ice on the outside, you get out and scrape. It'd be nice to have a surface that was not hydrophilic, was hydrophobic, wouldn't form that. That's an easy one to work on. Self-monitoring food packaging, this is a safety issue. You walked into the store and you see your package of cheese, and is that the way it came out of the manufacturer, or was some kid who was stocking the shelves at 3 o'clock last night driving fast on a little cart around the store and it fell off, landed on the ground, the cellophane broke, was picked up, resealed, and stuck back on the shelf. And if you're the cheesemaker, you really want to prevent people from doing that second thing because some infectious organism like staph could get in there and you get a staph infection and you could wind up suing the cheese manufacturer. So I'd like to be able to do that. Neuronal interfaces, in other words, can you draw an interface between a computer and your nervous system? That's a complicated problem. Fully targeted drug delivery. Huge amounts of progress have been made on this, but it's still true for the most part that something like chemotherapy kills the whole body in order to kill one part. That's not what you want. And one way to do that is to build nanoscale receptors that can actually find the cancer cells and specifically go after them. Heatless light. And the one that I'm really hot on at the moment, and I hope everybody else in the world is hot on at the moment, which is truly efficient solar radiation capture. The world is in an energy crisis. We are, as the State of the Union said a few weeks ago, addicted to foreign oil. We're addicted to oil in general. We're using hydrocarbons. We are causing global change. It'd be nice to use the fusion plant that's 93 million miles away. It provides lots of fusion energy every day. In order to do that, we need to efficiently capture the light that comes from the sun. It's a little hard to imagine doing that in an efficient and inexpensive fashion without using nanostructures. So these are some of the targets that we'd like to go after. So what is the road ahead? Well, Niels Bohr said predicting the future is very difficult. Here are a few predictions that are out there. This is probably incorrect. It was the director of the U.S. Patent Office. It was probably 1909, not 1929. And this is not exactly the wording that he used, but it's close. He says, we should close this office. Everything that needs to be invented is already. This is 1909. Think about what was out there, what you could buy compared to what you can buy now. So the director of the U.S. Patent Office didn't do a very good job of predicting. Thomas J. Watson, Jr., modern founder of IBM, said a few computers should be enough for the society. Apart from the grammar being incorrect, this one is remarkable too. Infectious diseases is now history. Surgeon General, 1959. Notice that Watson should have known something about computers. The director of the patent office should have known something about patents. Surgeon General should have known something about infectious disease. And Bill Gates should have known something about how much memory we all want. He said 640K should be enough for everyone. So predicting the future is very difficult. But what I think is clear is that these nanostructures are going to be a major part of the future. And as we go forward, we're going to be hearing a lot more about them and feeling their importance in our daily lives. So the prediction that I think is almost certainly right was made by a young man living on a pond in Massachusetts in the second half of the 19th century. Thoreau ends his book by saying, there's more day to dawn, the sun is but a morning star. What we've seen in nanoscience and nanotechnology is just the beginning of a very new theme in the way that science and technology will change the world that we live in. We hope for the better. Okay.